Welcome to That Medic Podcast, your bi-weekly dose
of all things digital health, global health, and leadership.
My name is Success, a student at Cambridge University.
And I am Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
Join us as we chat with some top professionals in healthcare. Enjoy.
In this podcast, we spoke to Dr. Amol Navache, an associate professor of health policy and medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. We discussed the inefficiencies in how the U.S. pays for healthcare, how behavioral economics can increase the affordability and quality of care, and his work across government, academia, and the private sector to drive change forward. Today's show is perfect for anyone excited about forging an interdisciplinary career in medicine or just intrigued by health policy. So without further ado, let's have a listen. Hi, Dr. Navache. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with us. So we normally start the podcast by asking the question, why did you decide to study medicine?
I decided to study medicine because I was fundamentally interested in the human endeavor. And I was mathematically, kind of technologically inclined kid, but I wasn't as excited about making cell phone chips or other applications that a lot of my colleagues were when I was an undergrad at Stanford. And instead, I wanted to do something that had broad social impact and that made people's lives better. And so I found a way to basically blend my technocratic kind of interests, if you will, with the more humanitarian side of medicine in this space of healthcare, broadly speaking.
No, certainly. And I know you studied electrical engineering at Stanford. You went from there to transitioning to working at McKinsey afterward. And you also spent some time at the White House, I understand, as a fellow for the Council of Economic Advisors. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about each of these experiences and sort of compare and contrast them for me as you're this emerging medical student.
Sure. So, you know, thematically, I think one of the things that's common across my career is that I've been interested in the scholarly and academic aspects of making contributions to advance the way we think about things, but then also trying to understand how that actually intersects with policy from a government perspective and then from a commercial perspective in the private sector. And so both of those experiences were, for me, very foundational. So working at McKinsey gave me a very kind of basic business training, if you will. And probably more importantly than the training and the skills I got was just exposure. So working in the health sector, working with technology companies that were doing DNA chips, working with device manufacturers, working with hospitals and health systems, and just understanding how the business side of healthcare influences the clinical and the humanitarian side of healthcare was really important as, in fact, just providing a lens for me through which to view the world and try to understand it better. And working in the White House was fantastic because I ended up working primarily in the executive branch, but at the White House, you end up getting to interface with all the branches of the government. And so it gave me a sense for what can the government do effectively and what are the many, many, many things that the government can't do effectively and efficiently. And that started to formulate, I think, a hypothesis for my own career going forward, which is how am I going to try to influence healthcare in as many ways as possible? Because there's no one single way that's perfect.
No, certainly. And you went on then, following these experiences, to train as an MD PhD at the University of Pennsylvania with your PhD in healthcare management and economics from Wharton. So I'm really curious. I know you have a special interest in behavioral economics. What motivated that interest? And I'm curious how that has shaped your clinical work or how you think clinically speaking.
I got very interested when I was at McKinsey, in fact, in physicians as agents for patients, physicians as agents for society, physicians as agents for health systems and hospitals that they worked for. So the centrality around physicians, and one of the unique things about physicians is they're not only a coordinating center in a sense, but they're also, they play this unique role in the health system in which they can sort of generate demand for services because they say, hey, you know what? You need to get an MRI. You need to come back for a visit. And so as a patient, you know, we typically then follow the advice that we're given. And so, so they play this incredibly important role, but they do that with this responsibility too, right? This amazing responsibility for somebody else's life, somebody else's best interest. And so I became very interested in how do physicians actually function here, and how do they balance their economic interests, their own personal economic interests, from the broader economic interests, from the interests of their patients. And my PhD work actually focused on that, trying to understand that using economics as a lens. But what I realized, and this was emerging at the time because Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky are really Kahneman, but their work was awarded the Nobel Prize in behavioral economics or in economics for psychology work, which was itself kind of foundational and surprising. So I was very influenced by this point that people, just, and physicians are people, are irrational in predictable ways. And how might that influence the way that physicians are caring for patients and making their own decisions? And so my PhD work actually was a blend of behavioral economics and traditional economics, in the sense that I looked at some of these distortions in how clinicians interpret information and then applied that within a more traditional economic framework. And I think what I learned from that is, fundamentally, we have to not only get the economics right, we have to get the psychology right in terms of improving our healthcare system. And that has led to this broad interest in behavioral economics as applied to healthcare clinicians and providers and organizations. And that's where a lot of my work has then centered, including on the policy side, including on the commercial side now.
No, it's really fascinating. A couple of things to follow up on. For our listeners, Kahneman, I've read, there's some great books, The Undoing Project by Michael Lewis, and his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, that are worth following up with. And it's really interesting what you note about sort of the competing interests, right, that physicians have, right? The fee-for-service model that traditionally dominates, where they're motivated to order as many tests from an economics standpoint, right? The psychological biases that you mentioned, I'm sure, like, there's a number that I'm familiar with, like anchoring bias, confirmation bias, et cetera, et cetera. So I think this is really fascinating, and I want to transition more to the research side of things, because I know that after finishing your internal medicine residency at the Brigham, you ultimately came back to Penn, where you now serve as co-director of the Healthcare Transformation Institute and the associate director of the Center for Health Incentives and Behavioral Economics. And I know that your research is focused on payment model design and evaluation. So at a high level, I was wondering if you could explain some of the inefficiencies and unfairness in the current model through which the US pays for healthcare.
Yeah, so this is a great question. And I think one of the interesting things is our health system differs from other health systems in, you know, other nations and countries in many, many different ways. The primary way that it differs is actually in how we provide insurance. So, you know, many European, other developed countries provide insurance through the government primarily, and it's social insurance. But the interesting thing is that the way that most governments and most payers or insurance companies pay for care is very similar to the US. So it's actually a global problem. It's an international problem, which is we tend to view healthcare delivery, and we tend to pay for healthcare delivery in this very transactional way. And I'll tell you a funny story. So I advised the government of Singapore, the Minister of Health, on health financing. And in the first meeting where they convened a set of experts, I was amongst a very small number of Americans in the room. And there was a bunch of experts from New Zealand, Australia, the Netherlands, Switzerland, you know, a bunch of other countries that have more highly functioning systems than we do from a cost efficiency perspective. And for that matter, so is Singapore's. And one of the other international folks who shall remain nameless, you know, said to the Singapore leadership, they said, "Why the heck would you have an American here? I mean, have you taken a look at their system?" And I blushed a little bit, but at the end of the day, I think one of the reasons is that the area that I work in, which is again this notion of how do we pay for delivery to get the outcomes that we get, it's actually a fairly universal thing, although of course I study in the US healthcare context. And finally, coming to your question, so we pay for care traditionally in this very transactional way, which we call fee for service, meaning we pay a fee for a service. And the more services that somebody does, the more fees they get and the more income they get as a consequence, right? So what's the prevailing incentive in fee for service? It's do more, because the more you do, the more you get paid. And it doesn't really matter what the health value is of that service. In some sense, even if you're acting in the best interest of your patients, you can feel morally good about it. If you feel like there's any small iota of health benefit, then I should be ordering a test or I should be doing a procedure. And it doesn't matter if it costs $50 or if it costs $5,000, right? And that has put our system into this inexorable, you know, price increase world, right? Where spending keeps going up and up and up. And the Medicare Trust Fund, you know, I can give you a lot of headlines, but, you know, now it's 2030, but one way or another, we're going to go bankrupt soon. It's kind of how it feels. And so the orientation of my work is to understand what are the different ways we can pay for care that aren't anchored in the fee-for-service world that can generate more efficiencies while protecting against the other disincentives. Because at the end of the day, there's no financing system that's perfect. And so we need to be able to balance, monitor, track. And, you know, one of the bugaboos that I think we've uncovered, my group and a couple of others, is that when you have these kinds of value-based programs that are intending to pay for healthcare value and not for the volume of services, is unintentionally, we can actually harm populations that are marginalized or low income or face a lot of disparities. So there's a lot of work to be done, but that's really where my work focuses.
That's a really good point on the potential adverse consequences for equity that some groups, right, might be like, if they're more sick, right, they might be selected out. Physicians might not want to care for them under these value-based models. You know, something I want to focus on a little bit more is that I know you do a lot of work specifically on bundled payments. So for our listeners at home who might not be familiar, can you briefly explain what these bundled payments are?
Sure. So let's first quickly talk about what happens in the fee-for-service context. Yes. So imagine, Summer, that your grandma was going to get a new hip. Okay. So right now what happens is grandma goes for her pre-admission testing to check on her hemoglobin A1C and her cholesterol and whatever else. And so those tests are paid by the insurance company in a transactional way to the lab. The physician who did that visit gets paid transactionally for separately. Then let's fast forward now. So now grandma's in the hospital. The hospital gets paid for the surgery, but really the operating room and the room and board and the supplies. The anesthesiologist gets paid separately for the anesthesia, and the surgeon gets paid separately for doing the surgery. And then grandma needs to go to a nursing home afterwards to get some rehab. The nursing home gets paid separately. The physician at the nursing home gets paid separately. So you get the point, right? The idea of a bundle payment is basically, look, we don't pay for cars by paying for the steering wheel separately and the tire separately. You know, we pay for the whole car, right? So the point here is that if grandma's getting a hip or a knee surgery, we should pay for the hip and knee surgery starting from step one all the way through grandma can walk again. Mm-hmm. And the idea of a bundle payment is taking these clinically defined, so hip or knee replacement surgery, for example, clinically defined episodes of care, and putting a single price tag on them, mm-hmm. and then linking that to quality outcomes so that there's some accountability for the quality of the product too.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. And I was wanting to talk to you a little bit more then on sort of how does the behavioral econ work and you sort of your interest there fit into some of this research that you do into bundled payments, into alternative payment models and the equity component as well.
So behavioral economics, let's just think about it as the psychology of how clinicians make decisions, right? And so any kind of payment paradigm change is fundamentally trying to get people to practice care differently. And so initially, some of the work that we did was looking at organizations that participated in programs like bundled payments, and those particularly that were successful, to say, hey, what are they doing differently to get better outcomes at lower cost? And what we found is that they actually not intentionally, right, they kind of organically arrived at using these tools and methods that used behavioral economic principles. So for example, they would show comparative performance data between their surgeons, and they would run these lunchtime sessions where they put up people's data in an unblinded fashion and said, hey, you know, Dr. Smith, your joint replacement outcomes are worse than Dr. Lee's or whatever. And that uses a principle around relative social ranking, right? They prepaid incentives using a principle called loss aversion. So what we realize is that the most successful organizations are incorporating these behavioral economic techniques into the way that they managed care so that they can influence clinicians to be as effective and efficient as possible. And so what I have tried to do is study the bundle payment and other kinds of payment model mechanisms at a high level, but then also do a complementary set of work that's been testing how we use these behavioral economic principles in practice as effectively as possible so that we can bring them together. You know, we have the macro together with the micro, and that means that we can achieve outcomes better. Otherwise, you leave something on the table one way or another.
Right, right. No, that's really interesting because it feels that many researchers often practice in a silo, so to say, right? That in one domain or the other, so you see only half the battle. So it's really fascinating that you're trying to do work across the value chain. You know, beyond your academic research, I want to focus on some of the other experiences you have per your earlier comment about sort of the diversity of domains you've tried to work in. So I know you're the commissioner of the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, or MedPAC, which is a nonpartisan agency that advises U.S. Congress on Medicare policy. So I was wondering if you could tell me more about the work MedPAC does and why it's so important to have physicians working directly with Congress on health policy.
So MedPAC plays a very important role, which is, as you mentioned, nonpartisan, and I think doggedly objective is maybe how I might try to describe us, is trying to provide data and also very explicit policy recommendations to Congress. And then we also provide feedback to Medicare, CMS, on their policymaking. And so we are kind of an objective arbiter of truth, in a sense, of the evidence of what rational policy would look like. And then subsequently, it goes through the political process if it's going to go through legislation. But we also help to differentiate for Congress and for CMS what requires legal changes, statutory changes. So when do we need a new law versus when does Medicare as a regulatory authority have the ability to do things, to make changes? And so we work at this intersection, essentially between the legislative branch, although we sit in the legislative branch officially, we kind of sit at this interface. And because of separation of powers, in fact, we have some ability to cross that aisle, the branch aisle, that other stakeholders in the government can't do as effectively. And so that's the role that we play. And, you know, I've been in the vice chairman of this commission now for a little bit over a year now. And it's been a fascinating learning experience for me as well. I would say, you know, I hope I've contributed something. I can definitely tell you that I've learned a lot.
No, certainly. I mean, my understanding is that what happens on Congress takes a while. It can be slow moving, but it's important work, of course. Beyond sort of the policy realm, you've also tackled, I mean, these issues of healthcare affordability and quality from sort of the technological and private sector angle. Specifically, you co-founded the company Embedded Healthcare, which has a stated goal to accelerate value-based payment model implementation and bring behavioral economics to the physician's office. So I know that Embedded Healthcare was recently acquired. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about why you started that company. I mean, you're doing so much already, right? Why add another thing to your bag and why it was important to do this work?
Well, you know, the fundamental mission of my career and really my life has been to try to improve healthcare. And as I mentioned, I had these foundational experiences when I was in my early 20s that taught me that there are constraints around each of these different levers, call them the policy levers, the commercial levers, et cetera, the scientific levers. And so what my goal has then been is to try to affect all of those. And it struck me, and you know, quite frankly, I landed in a meeting with Bill Gates at one point in the context of Embedded Healthcare, and he basically said, "Look, what's your commercial model for change? Because you know, you can try to do it through policy, but it takes a long time, and it goes through a political process. But in our capitalist economy, the best way to drive change is to have a truly successful commercial model." And that was very, very influential in my thinking. I think at the time, actually, we were contemplating starting Embedded Healthcare. It wasn't named that, but starting it as a nonprofit instead of as a for-profit, kind of in this mission orientation. And it struck me that, you know, not surprisingly, Bill Gates was right. You know, if we're really going to scale these ideas and make them easily adoptable, leverage technology to the hilt, then we had to do this through a commercial enterprise. And that's what Embedded Healthcare has been about. And that's, you know, we've now amassed, I think, a successful track record of being able to actually change practice patterns in physicians' office using these techniques that were initially tested in my lab, together with other partners, of course, but in my lab at the University of Pennsylvania. And now they're commercialized at scale. And the reason that we combined forces with Clarify Health is because Clarify has this amazing data resource that we needed to really, again, scale as fast as we can. So that's why I've been spending time in the private sector too. And I think at the end of the day, if one wants to try to really have broad scale impact, certainly working in any of these domains is rewarding, but working across all of them, it's a dream come true.
Right. No, certainly. I mean, you've really tackled health policy from so many different angles, right? Consulting, government, academic research, the private sector. And you're obviously a very accomplished leader across all these domains. So I want to understand, right, for the students listening to this podcast, right, is there a story that speaks out to you about the benefit of sort of having sort of this diverse range of expertise and sort of what it has taught you about leadership and leading across domains?
Yeah, so I think part of the trick, of course, is trying to understand your own phenotype and who you are and where you excel. And somewhere along the way, I think I learned that I'm not as good at econ as the economists. I'm not as good at medicine as my clinician colleagues. I'm not as good at engineering as my engineering colleagues. But where I thrive is really when these disciplines meet. And connecting the dots across the different disciplines was something that I got really jazzed about. And so I think, to the listeners, I would say, really identifying what you're passionate about and then identifying what are the disciplines that might be related to that passion, right? And oftentimes, especially in the sophistication of our world today, it's very unlikely that there's only one discipline that has a point of view on what you're doing. And when you attack things from different disciplines, you realize that there's actually a lot that's still not understood and that each of them actually thinks about the problems in a very different way. And that's really helpful because it's mind bending, but it also creates opportunity to try to generate some change.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. Sort of the different epistemologies and what you can learn from them and then sort of bring together and integrate. I think that nearly wraps up this episode. But before we go, I wanted to ask you for your three pieces of advice for students interested in a similarly interdisciplinary and diverse career pathway as yours.
Sure. So I think the first thing, as I just said, is really try to find your passion. Because if work is work, it's very hard to be as influential. It's very hard to put in the long hours and make the sacrifices that are needed, I think, to really drive a lot of change. So first step, got to find your passion. And I would say second step that goes right alongside that is don't be afraid to try a lot of things. I think sometimes, and I felt this way as a 20-something year old or even before that, late teenager in college, is we're all driven to succeed and we've had success and it feels scary to fail. But if we don't try a lot of things, we can intellectualize about it to the nth degree, but we don't really understand what it means until you go and do it. So don't be afraid to try a lot of things. And I think that's a very necessary journey. I would say many of my mentors who've had this intersectional impact have tried many different things. And guess what? They failed at some of them and that's okay. And I failed at things too along the way, right? I think it's hard to learn if you don't fail. And then the third thing is, I would say, be deliberate about your impact. Because unfortunately, every discipline, every hat that I wear, my academic hat, my commercial hat, my policy hat, there's forces there that narrow the definitions of success or objectives to something that's generally short of impact. So just to pick on my academic colleagues for a second, we can view success as having a paper in a top tier journal or something, but that's not the same thing as impact. And so one of the things that's prompted me to base myself in academia is it allows me to generate new ideas, to generate new insights. But the reason that I've had to step out into the policy world in the private sector is because I've never been satisfied with that. I've always been about the impact. And if I couldn't have impact from where I was sitting, gosh darn it, I was going to leave. So that's really important, I think, is really keep your life goal, your career goal at the forefront, and don't let the provinciality of whatever organization or sector or discipline or whatever you happen to be in, don't let it color you or somehow lose sight of the true goal.
What a great note to end on. It's this idea that keep your purpose as your guiding light. Don't seek a proxy of the purpose. So thank you so much, Dr. Navathi. This is wonderful. It was great speaking with you.
Great speaking with you too. Thank you for having me.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. You can also head to the description of this podcast to follow us on all social media so that you don't miss out on any of our content.